Accession number 27814, it's David Butt, Reel 10. Now, we were talking about after when you got to Gibraltar aboard HMS Reward, and what happened next? I mean, what about the towing of the Vanguard? Is it, because the Vanguard's an interesting ship in some ways. It's quite famous, although it never did much.
But that's right.
It's huge. It's the main thing that comes to mind. Yeah. How was the tow? You were supervised, not
we were supervising tug. Yes, there were three Royal Fleet Auxiliary tugs actually going out the tow. It needed three to control it because of the size. I mean, it was basically a bit of a sad occasion, I suppose. You know, to think that a ship that size and to just to look at a so powerful had been sitting around for years, basically unused. I mean, did attend a few things here and there. I don't think it ever took part in anything of any major significance, even in exercises. And the tow itself was completely uneventful, basically. It was
so the weather had improved?
The weather had vastly improved. It was quite calm nearly all the way home. So it was really completely uneventful. I mean, they had a small skeleton crew on the Vanguard, of course, just to supervise the tow rope. And to check the steering, etc. But other than that, nothing really happened, just straight up to Scotland. They took her in. I think they took her straight in to the dockyard. I don't think she anchored off. And that was it. We just dispersed from there on. Back to our normal duties.
Now, anything else happened before you were drafted to the Britannia? It's about 6 months in all, but anything else happened?
No, the only significant thing, I mean, just general towing, etc., etc. The only significant thing, I think you asked me yesterday whether the tow line had ever broken. In actual fact, it did break once, but that wasn't towing a ship, it was towing the target.
Tell us about that, because that can be dangerous. Tell us what happened.
It was very dangerous. It was rough weather. We were just towing the target, and so they're about 300 tons, these targets, and the tow parted because of the pressure of the wind, etc., on the tow. And before we knew what was happening, we just saw the tow go shooting past and overtook us, you know, and just carried on, and we had to chase it. We could keep it in sight, that wasn't a problem, but it took a while to catch up because it was going at a fair old speed in that wind. It was basically acting like a yacht. And eventually caught it up, and then the difficult part was hooking it up again. And that was extremely dangerous. I mentioned yesterday that we'd had these ex-Merchant Navy fellas, some of them are now in the Navy, and we had two in particular, two great friends, really great friends, fantastic seamen. And they volunteered to jump on board the tow to hook it up, which they did. Very precarious. They managed to get on board with great difficulty without actually falling off again. And they hooked the tow line up, and we scrambled them back on board. They were actually given a tot when they got back on board, an appreciation from the skipper. But that was a bit of a hairy moment, because if it actually collided with anything, I think it was in the North Sea, it could have been very, very dangerous. We obviously did have to advise, you know, Admiralty, etc., that what had happened, and it was on the loose for a while. But it was a few hours before we actually got it back under control.
Did the line actually cause any damage, the whiplash?
No, it didn't. Don't know exactly how it happened. There probably was, apart from somebody just checking that the tow seemed to be okay, I don't think anybody realised that. I think what happened is suddenly the target was pulled back from the ship, and just a sudden tension, and it just went. I think it actually snapped closer to the reward than it did to the tow. So there was virtually very little of the wire to bound back, and so luckily there was no danger there.
Anything else about the reward, or should we move to the Britannia? Because in February 58 you go to the Britannia.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there was nothing really significant on the reward after that. No. So yes, the Britannia came next. As I mentioned, I was asked, sort of enticed into volunteering by this mate of mine. When I actually got on board the Britannia after, and what we did, it was about a dozen of us that were going on at one time. We were in barracks in Portsmouth for a while we got kitted out, naval tailors, etc. Because a lot of their kit is different. You have the uniform itself is different. And everything you wear has normally got the Royal Yacht flash on it. So that all has to be prepared before you go on board. So we just spent.
In what way is it different? I mean, is it just the flash, or is it?
The uniform itself has a bow at the back. It's styled on an old-fashioned navy, if you like. It has a bow at the back of the jacket. It has a different frontage to the jacket. The trousers are slightly different, and you have buckles on your shoes. This is obviously on your dress uniform. Otherwise, everything you wear that is normally shown has the Royal Yacht flash on it, on your shoulders, on your white fronts, etc. We'll have it on the front of that, and your cap tally, of course, will be Royal Yacht. So basically, it was just a few weeks in barracks while all this was getting ready, and then off we went to join at Portsmouth.
Now, what was your reception on joining?
Don't recall it all that much, to be honest. I don't think it was really any different to joining any other ship. It is a naval ship, and it is operated on very similar lines to a naval ship. So we were greeted probably by the chief yeoman. Senior chief yeoman. There were two chief yeomen on the yacht, and he would just have taken us down the mess, introduced us to the permanent crew, who are, we did 2 years as a temporary crew. Permanent crew is on there for life, unless they volunteer to come off or get thrown off, or actually.
Now, what proportions are there? I mean,
it's a third is permanent crew. A third of the crew is permanent, and two thirds go on for a 2 year spell, and followed by a major refit, so that the ship is back to its prestige, appearance, etc. I mean, it's very rarely actually gets any different, to be honest. But they have to check everything on the mechanical side, the engines, etc.
Now, I mean, people can go and visit the ship. I think it's in Edinburgh, Leith, yep, or somewhere. Yep. So I don't want to go too far down, because but what were your first impressions of the ship as a ship?
I think it's a magnificent looking ship. And it's called a yacht, and it's styled like a yacht in a way, obviously a very large yacht. You have the three masts, obviously no sails, but there's a rake to the masts. It really does look very streamlined, and what hits you, I think, most is the paintwork. The paintwork is absolutely immaculate, and it's a gloss. Both the dark blue and the white is a gloss paint. Having said that, it's a swine to put on. It's like glue. It really is terrible stuff to paint with, and we do have to paint while you're on there, to just bits and pieces, or to spruce up whatever, depending if you've had some rough weather. But yeah, I think.
Would you paint all of it or just parts?
No, that's done in the 2 year refit. That would be probably complete. completely repainted. But no, you paint as necessary. Again, with signal staff, you'd paint up on the flag deck in particular. Seamen would do ship side, and most of the upper deck works if necessary. And obviously, you can only do that if you're not actually going royalty at the time. It's really on passage or while you're waiting or whatever.
Now, what was your mess deck like? Was there a signals?
There was a communications mess deck, and in common with other ships, it was we were on the starboard side forward, and the electricians on the port side forward. So very similar. The mess decks, apart from the fact that we did have bunks, I think everybody had a bunk. But apart from that, it was very little different to a standard ship. I think that's what people find a bit strange, that the comparison between the upper deck, royal quarters, etc., and the mess decks. And this is why when I went to see her in Leith, I asked specifically if we could go down below, and we couldn't at that time, well, you can now. Because I wanted the family to see that where we lived wasn't quite the same as where everybody else or the VIPs, etc., were actually living. It would be interesting to know whether they've actually done anything with that and to tart it all up to give people the impression that it was much better down below than. It was comfortable. It was comfortable enough, and obviously clean, etc. But one very unusual thing, and I still find this very unusual to this day, and how they let us do it, I don't know. But when we were in Portsmouth for a little spell, I went to see our divisional officer and said, "Would there be any objection to us tarting up our own mess?" He said, "Well, what do you mean by tarting up your own mess?" I said, "Well, we'd like to panel it." He said, "Panel it?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "It can be done." I said, "It's not difficult. It's plywood. You've got the normal ribs of the ship going around." I said, "We don't have to screw into the ribs. You don't have to bolt it on or anything." I said, "You can cut the plywood so it actually fits over the ribs, you see." And I said, "Then we'll paper it." And I don't know, I think he must have gone to see the first lieutenant, commander, as it is on the yacht rather than the first lieutenant. And the answer came back, "Yeah, why not?" So we did that. We bought some plywood and we panelled out our mess deck. And it did look quite smart, you know. And electricians, of course, on the other side, saw what we were doing and put in the same request because they couldn't turn it down, you see. But they had to go one better, of course, so they put up wall lights. Now, that was still there when I came off. Whether it stayed there, probably not. It was probably ripped out on the next refit. But it would be interesting to know how long it actually did stay there. But it really does amaze me that they ever approved that, because it was probably a virus for a start.
Now, the one thing about the ship that's unusual is that there's a different way of communicating orders about it.
Yeah.
I mean, now, can you talk to me about that a bit?
That really is the biggest difference between a normal naval ship and the Britannia. They have no pipe commands, no bugles, nothing like that, for obvious reasons. The last thing the royal family want to be done is woken up with a bugle or a pipe at various times of the night or day. So the daily orders are issued to every individual on the mess deck the previous evening, and that is a complete itinerary for the next day, coupled with what uniform you have to be in, either the dress that you have to wear, depending on where the yacht is going to be. And that is your standing order for the following day, and that is what you're expected to follow and to be wherever you're supposed to be at the right time. And that's, you know, I mean, that, it's very rare, I think, for anybody not to do it, because obviously the whole mess is doing it anyway. So you don't really get the opportunity to, you know, to miss anything at all. You have to abide by that timetable. The really interesting part about that is the number of times you might have to change your dress of the day. Because every time you go to sea, you change into working dress. Every time you go into harbour, you change into your number ones. That's, of course, when royalty are on board. So, yeah, that's the bit that you have to allow time for. You know, in between whatever duties, you've got to go back down the mess, change, get back up to your place of duty in time for whatever's coming next. The most difficult one we had was when we were doing the world tour with the Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh.
Now, which came first? What was your perhaps keep a bit? What was your first tour that you remember?
I can't remember the smaller tours of the order they came in. I mean, they were just
Take them in the tours as you remember them.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the major tours were the round the world trip with the Duke of Edinburgh, and that was for 5 months, I think.
Well, tell us about that.
Yeah.
Now, what sort of entourage would he have on board?
Well, the Duke would bring his own household staff, of course, probably not as many as when the Queen is, definitely not as many as when the Queen is on board, because she has hairdressers and all the rest of it. I don't know whether the Duke had a hairdresser, he might well have done. But, yeah, I mean, he would bring his own household staff as necessary. Chefs would come on board, and they may be not necessarily from Paris, they may be seconded from other places. Not for the world tour, but for the Canadian trip. I know we had an army chef on board, a young fella who was purported to be a very good chef, and you know, he was sent on there. I mean, he would just have the relevant staff that he would need, his equerry and that sort of thing. He wouldn't normally bring security staff, although there would probably be ones that you weren't aware of with security staff, maybe, because that was part of the Royal Marine duties, with escort and supervision on the upper deck, particularly if the children were on board. It was...
Well, now, on this occasion, he was on his own. There was no other member of the Royal Family.
No other members of the Royal Family. It was purely a trip for him, and I think it was partly a reminiscence trip, going back to places he'd been in the Navy, like Hong Kong, and actually meeting people that he'd met previously. One obvious one is Susie's side party. in Hong Kong, they have what they call side parties, and these are Chinese girls who come and live on board, and they clean the ship. The cleaning of the ship was actually taken out of the hands of the crew in that stage. I live aboard in Hong Kong, and sometimes they travel, if we're only going in the relevant area close by, not too far distant or not too long, they actually stay on board. They do the cleaning, and they live off scraps. To be honest, they issue a polished waste bin to every mess deck, and you put all decent waste food into these polished bins. They come and collect it, and that's what they live on, in turn for actually looking after the ship. And Susie was a very well-known woman. I mean, she was a woman then, probably quite young when Prince first knew her. She was heading up the side party. It could be about five or six girls, or women. And he specifically asked that she come back on board so he could meet her again. Because there were all sorts of rumours about what happened when she first met her. It's irrelevant and completely unknown. As sailors will, there's always a rumour starts somewhere. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, he went to a few places that he obviously knew, met people like in Singapore and all the normal ports of call in the Far East. But the more interesting part from our point of view was around the small islands, South Pacific islands.
And what was that like?
That was very, very interesting. Because they were basically, some of them, no white people on the islands whatsoever. Some they had a very small contingent of maybe teachers. Ocean Island, for instance, they had a school and a little club. And the school was manned by English and Australian, I think, teachers. Not very large because there weren't all that many children. And we actually were invited to their club one evening when we were there. But I mean, what we liked about those islands was the welcome was absolutely phenomenal. Not just for the royal party, but for us. You know, you were followed by little children trying to push bananas into your pockets, and you know, their mums and dads all coming up trying to shake hands, and you know, and they spoke. You can only converse one way or another with them. And it was really interesting trip. Places like Borneo, you know, which in those days was nobody really went except for business and the like. And now it's a holiday resort. But, I mean, we played football and just about every stop if there was a team to play. We actually played, although we weren't aware of it at the time, we played the Borneo national side in a stadium, and the Duke actually came to watch that one, which is didn't normally. We thought we were just playing the team from Sandakan, which is a port we actually berthed in. We drew 1-1 with them, and then we were told that it was the Borneo national side, not the town. So we were quite chuffed about that. But yeah, I mean, we went to small islands and we played the natives at football, the natives in bare feet, although you wouldn't know it, feel them if you got kicked. playing football in 110 degrees in the shade, you know, it's so different to what a normal run of events, and it was a fantastic trip. And of course, there wasn't so much pomp because it was small islands. You know, they weren't too fussed about your full rig, you know, to enter harbour and this type of thing.
What did you think of the Duke of Edinburgh? I mean, did you see him much? I mean,
well, the Duke of Edinburgh is a naval officer, and that's how he is on board. He goes up the bridge quite a lot with the captain, who's a as far as I can understand, at those days anyway, was always a member of the royal family, you know, somewhere down the line. It was Rear Admiral Dornay was the captain when we were on there. So he used to go up on the bridge quite a lot, and I guess he probably used to take command.
Was he popular with the crew, the Edinburgh, Dublin, Prince Philip?
Well, he wasn't all that communicative, I don't think. I mean, he did speak to crew, mainly to pass the time of day and just sort of ask what they were doing, etc., etc. He wasn't all that chatted here, I must say. He was more with the officers, more concerned with, you know.
Did you actually see the royal apartments what were they like? I mean, I don't know whether you got a chance to see them informally.
Yes, they do open when there's no royalty on board. They do open the royal quarters to visitors on occasion, and we were allowed to to have a look around when they were empty as well. There was always a marine on the doorway, the main doorway into the quarters.
How luxurious were they?
The only part you can say was luxurious is the banquet hall, the banqueting room. And that's not over the top, not by a long way. The bedrooms are not elaborate at all, really. As far as I know, the bedrooms now that you can see are still as they were. May not be exactly the same furniture, but I think it's a replica. Obviously, the royal party, if they had anything favourite to take on board, they would take it on board, you know, if it was a long trip. But I think generally the furniture was just a fixture, and that's what they used. They used to take a Rolls Royce. There's a garage on board. They used to take a Rolls Royce on board for them to use. I don't really know why that was, because I'm sure practically everywhere we went there were, you know, a Rolls Royce or similar provided if they wanted it, but they did used to take it, and it did used to go ashore. You know, it's just the things they needed rather than extra luxuries. The staff, household staff, etc., whether that was over the top or not, I don't know. I don't think it really could have been, because there wasn't that much accommodation for them, you know, it's limited. So I think they only took the number of staff that they wanted. But I think the whole point of the yacht, and this is why it's so sad that it's gone, it was, I think, the only place that the royal family could get 100% peace and quiet from anybody. Because as far as the crew concerned, we apart from if you pass the Queen first thing in the morning, you would say, good morning, Your Majesty. After that, if you saw her again, it would be ma'am. But in general, you completely ignore them. And they might be playing deck tennis or something up on the royal deck. And if you had to go down there, and on our side we did have to, because we had flags down there and the ensign and aft, etc., you just ignore them. Which is exactly what they wanted and how it was supposed to be. Now they have nothing like that. I know they can go to their Balmoral and the lights, but I still don't think it's the same. The Queen loved it on there, I think, except she wasn't a good sailor. So she didn't normally travel too far in the yacht. She normally flew to pick it up somewhere else. But Duke, of course, was fine. Queen Mother loved it on there. I mean, getting back to the world tour, I mean, it was I've got the itinerary here of that and the Canadian trip. So it was a lot of small islands and the like, places that probably nobody'd been to before, including Prince Philip, I guess. Somebody'd obviously drawn up this itinerary in conjunction with him, and they'd agreed what they would like to see, I guess. But it was very informal. Most of these smaller places were quite informal with the Duke himself. He was carried on a canoe, for instance, by natives onto the beach and this type of thing. It was all very relaxed sort of atmosphere. And we could have banyans, you know, picnics on remote islands while he was ashore somewhere. We could get a motorboat and be taken across to an island and play football or go swimming or whatever.